York. This is Democracy Now! Guilty, guilty, guilty. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been convicted of all three charges of murdering George Floyd.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter, as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty.
Derek Chauvin is the first white Minnesota police officer ever to be convicted of killing a black person. George Floyd's family is vowing to keep fighting for racial justice.
We have to protest because it seems like this is a never-ending cycle.
Yeah.
Reverend Al always told me, we got to keep fighting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put up a fight every day because I'm not just fighting for George anymore. I'm fighting for everybody around this world.
We'll go to Minneapolis to speak with Candace Montgomery of the Black Visions Collective, plus Harvard professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Guilty. 3 weeks after the start of a trial that was watched around the world, a jury of 12 Hennepin County residents delivered their verdict on the three counts against former police officer Derek Chauvin, who murdered George Floyd last May by kneeling on his neck for 9.5 minutes. Judge Peter Cahill read the unanimous verdict.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter, as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter, as to count two, third-degree murder perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter, as to count three, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
Jurors deliberated for just over 10 hours before delivering their guilty verdicts. Judge Cahill revoked Chauvin's bail and will sentence him in 8 weeks. He faces up to 40 years in prison for the most serious charge, second-degree murder. It's the first time a white officer has been found guilty of murdering a person of color in Minnesota. An NPR investigation found police officers have shot and killed at least 135 black men and women across the United States since 2015. At least three-quarters of those officers were white. On the streets of Minneapolis and around the country, protesters greeted the news with joy, relief, and vows to keep fighting. George Floyd's murder last May set off a global movement for racial justice and against police brutality. George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, responded to the verdict at a news conference with other family members and civil rights leaders.
I'm gonna put up a fight every day because I'm not just fighting for George anymore. I'm fighting for everybody around this world.
Yeah.
I get calls, I get DMs, people from Brazil, from Ghana, from Germany, everybody, London, Italy, they're all saying the same thing. We won't be able to breathe until you're able to breathe.
Oh, that's right.
Today, we are able to breathe again.
Oh, yeah.
After headlines, we'll spend the rest of the hour on the historic verdicts and the reactions they have garnered. Protests broke out in Columbus, Ohio, Tuesday night after a police officer fatally shot a black teenage girl. 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant was reportedly in an altercation with two people, and police claimed they thought she was going to stab someone before an officer shot her four times. The unnamed officer has been put on leave. She was killed shortly before Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murdering George Floyd. Micaiah Bryant had been staying at a foster home. Her mother, Paula Bryant, spoke to a local news channel about the last time she saw her daughter.
We hugged each other. She said, Mommy, I made honor roll. And she said, Mommy, I'm looking forward to coming home. Micaiah had a motherly nature about her. She promoted peace. And that's something that I want to always be remembered.
A judge has denied a motion to toss the 20-year prison sentence of former police officer Michael Slager, who murdered unarmed black motorist Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. Slager tried to argue that his defense was ineffective, but the federal judge ruled, quote, a careful review of this entire tragic episode makes plain that Slager has no one to blame for his present predicament and sentence but himself. What sealed his fate was his own willful act of shooting an unarmed man in the back five times as he ran for his life, the judge said. In international news, India has hit a grim new coronavirus milestone with over 2,000 deaths in a day and close to 300,000 new cases. Hospitals are running low on oxygen and available beds amidst the devastating surge. Prime Minister Narendra Modi said India is facing a coronavirus storm, but is resisting another nationwide lockdown, calling instead for regional lockdowns. Meanwhile, the former king and queen of Nepal have tested positive for COVID-19 after attending the religious festival of Kumbh Mela in the northern Indian city of Haridwar, which has drawn millions of pilgrims in recent weeks. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador received his first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine Tuesday after weeks of mixed messages over whether he would get inoculated. He previously said he would not get the shot as he believed his January infection gave him sufficient COVID-19 antibodies. AMLO has come under fire for his response to the pandemic, including his refusal to issue a mask mandate or even wear one himself on many occasions. Mexico's official death toll is 213,000, the third highest in the world, but officials said last month the true number could be 60% higher. Here in the United States, the State Department's updating its travel advisories to recommend avoiding travel to 80% of the countries of the world because of coronavirus risks. Johnson & Johnson is resuming its rollout in Europe after the European Union drugs regulator said the vaccine may be linked to extremely rare blood clots, but that its benefits far outweigh its risks. The European regulator said the vaccine should carry a warning. It will be up to individual EU countries to decide whether and how to distribute the J&J vaccine. On Friday, a panel for the Centers for Disease Control will meet to make recommendations on its use in the U.S., which has been temporarily halted. New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey reintroduced their Green New Deal resolution Tuesday, over 2 years after it was first unveiled. It now has over 100 co-sponsors in the House. The plan would overhaul U.S. infrastructure, investing in clean energy and creating 20 million union jobs. This is Ocasio-Cortez at a news conference on Capitol Hill.
We're going to transition to a 100% carbon-free economy that is more unionized, more just, more dignified, and guarantees more health care and housing than we ever have before. That's our goal. That's the goal of a Green New Deal. What we're going to do is going to make sure that communities like Flint, Baltimore, the South Bronx, St. Louis, rural communities whose infrastructure was never properly built in the first place are first in line to rectify the injustices of the past.
Meanwhile, President Biden is expected to announce plans to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions at least in half by 2030, nearly doubling the target the U.S. committed to under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Biden has convened an international climate summit with world leaders, which will kick off Thursday, Earth Day. In Chad, the son of the late President Idriss Deby, Mohamed Idriss Deby, has been named interim head of state by a military council after his father died, reportedly while visiting frontline soldiers as they battled a rebel advance in the north of the country. The army has also enacted a nationwide curfew and announced Chad's land and air borders will be shut down. Rebel forces threatened to move towards the capital, prompting fears of further unrest. Idriss Debbie had been in power for over 30 years and was just announced the winner of a recent presidential election before his death. Rights groups are calling for a quick transition to democratic civilian rule and an accounting of human rights abuses under Debbie's reign. A new report by Reporters Without Borders says journalists in over 100 countries have been blocked from reporting on the coronavirus pandemic and other stories or retaliated against for their work. In its annual report on press freedom, the group also highlighted attacks on U.S. journalists by law enforcement while covering racial justice protests last summer. In Pakistan, veteran journalist Absar Alam was shot and wounded Tuesday while on a walk near his home in the capital, Islamabad. Officials have launched an investigation into the attack, which the Pakistani Minister of Information condemned as an assassination attempt. Alam has been a longtime vocal critic of Pakistan's military. Journalists are routinely targeted in Pakistan, with news organizations facing censorship from the military and government, where Reporters Without Borders recently ranked Pakistan near the very bottom of 180 countries for press freedom. Over 250 nonprofits, including Oxfam, Save the Children, and the International Rescue Committee, are urging governments around the world to increase aid for hunger relief programs. In a letter addressed to world leaders, the groups warn over 270 million people are facing acute food insecurity, with many, quote, teetering on the very edge of famine due to ongoing conflicts, the climate crisis, systemic inequities, and the pandemic. Oxfam recently noted, quote, only 26 hours of global military spending is enough to cover the $5.5 billion needed to help those most at risk, and called cuts to food aid by wealthy countries, quote, an extraordinary political failure. Back in the United States, the Biden administration has officially backed statehood for Washington, D.C., ahead of a House vote on the issue Thursday. The White House called on Congress to, quote, provide for a swift and orderly transition to statehood for the 700,000 Washington residents who are not fully represented in Congress. The bill is expected to pass the House, but faces an uphill battle in the evenly divided Senate, where it would need 60 votes to overcome a Republican filibuster. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti has proposed a guaranteed basic income pilot program, which would make L.A. the largest U.S. city to run such a program.
This year, Los Angeles will launch the largest guaranteed basic income pilot of any city in America. We have budgeted $24 million to provide $1,000 a month to 2,000 households for an entire year, no questions asked.
Data from a similar initiative in Stockton, California, has shown recipients had greater success in finding employment and improved mental health. Around 1 in 5 people in Los Angeles lives in poverty. Standing Rock water protector Steve Martinez has been released after more than 60 days behind bars for refusing to give testimony to a federal grand jury. Martinez was summoned as a witness in the case of Sophia Walansky, a water protector whose arm was severely wounded during a police crackdown on anti-pipeline protests in 2016. Prosecutors were attempting to shift blame for Walansky's injuries from law enforcement to water protectors. The campaign to free Steve Martinez blasted the use of grand juries as a, quote, divisive and cruel tool of repression. And supporters of imprisoned journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal say he underwent successful heart surgery Monday. Abu-Jamal got COVID-19 last month and was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, which he attributed to medical neglect and prison conditions. Advocates are demanding he not be shackled to his hospital bed and continue to call for his release. The African-American journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal is 66 years old and has been in prison for nearly 40 years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome again to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, a jury in Minneapolis has convicted former police officer Derek Chauvin on all 3 counts for murdering George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds last May. Chauvin is the first white police officer in Minnesota to ever be convicted of killing a black person. The jury reached its decision after 10 hours of deliberation. Just after 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Judge Peter Cahill read the jury's decision.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, as to count two, third-degree murder perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, as to count three, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
Moments later, Derek Chauvin was handcuffed and taken into custody. He'll be sentenced in 2 months. He faces up to 40 years in prison for the most serious charge, second-degree murder. Outside the Minneapolis courthouse, crowds erupted in cheers when the verdicts were announced. Residents of Minneapolis described feeling relieved by the jury's decision to convict Derek Chauvin.
With the verdict today, I feel like a weight's lifted off my shoulders, but I know that the work's not done. I know that there's a lot of work to do, but I think for today, black people have their pride, black people have their liberation. I think today is just a day to celebrate, but tomorrow's another day to work.
George Floyd's younger brother, Philonis, addressed reporters. He invoked the name of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old Chicago boy who was lynched in 1955 in Mississippi.
He was the first George Floyd.
Yes.
But today, you have the cameras all around the world to see and show what happened to my brother. It was a motion picture, the world seeing his life being extinguished. And I could do nothing but watch. We have to protest because it seems like this is a never-ending cycle.
Yeah.
Reverend Al always told me, we got to keep fighting.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I'm going to put up a fight every day because I'm not just fighting for George anymore. I'm fighting for everybody around this world.
Yeah.
I get calls. I get DMs. People from Brazil, from Ghana, from Germany, everybody, London, Italy, they're all saying the same thing. We won't be able to breathe until you're able to breathe.
That's right.
Today, we are able to breathe again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
George Floyd's nephew, Brandon Williams, also spoke and called for reforms to policing in the United States.
So today is a pivotal moment for America. It's something this country has needed for a long time now.
Yes.
And hopefully today is the start of that.
Tell them.
When I say a pivotal moment, we need change in this broken system. Mm-hmm. It was built to oppress us. We need police reform bad.
Yeah.
Yes.
These guys are able to wear a badge and go out in the field, which means that they're qualified and trained to do their job at a high level. But when you shoot and kill a man that's running away from you that doesn't pose a threat, either you're not qualified and undertrained, or it's a choice and you want to kill black men and women.
Yeah.
It's either one or the other.
Yeah.
And I think today, Keith Ellison and his team proved that just because you are the law, you're not above the law.
Yeah.
We need each and every officer to be held accountable.
That's right.
And until then, it's still scary to be a black man and woman in America and counting police.
Yeah.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton stood behind the family members as they spoke. Reverend Al Sharpton of the National Action Network spoke alongside the Floyd family.
We don't find pleasure in this.
No.
We don't celebrate a man going to jail. We would have rather George be alive.
Amen.
But we celebrate that we, because young people, white and black, some castigated, many that are here tonight, marched and kept marching and kept going.
That's right, Reverend.
Many of them looked down on, but they kept marching and wouldn't let this die.
Yes.
And this is an assurance to them that if we don't give up, that we can win some rounds. But the war and the fight is not over.
Not over.
Just 2 days from now, we're going to have to deal with the funeral of Dante Wright in this same county, the same area. We still have cases to fight, but this gives us the energy to fight on. And we are determined that we're going to fight until we make federal law the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act must be law.
Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison was in charge of the prosecution. He also referenced the recent police killing of Dante Wright in nearby Brooklyn Center, Minnesota.
We have seen Rodney King, Abner Louima, Oscar Grant, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, Laquan McDonald, Stephon Clark, Atiana Jefferson, Anton Black, Breonna Taylor, and now Dante Wright and Adam Toledo. This has to end. We need true justice. That's not one case. That is a social transformation that says that nobody's beneath the law and no one is above it. This verdict reminds us that we must make enduring, systemic, societal change.
Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison is the first African-American elected to statewide office in Minnesota and the first Muslim elected to statewide office anywhere in the United States. President Biden addressed the nation Tuesday and condemned systemic racism.
It was a murder in the full light of day, and it ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see. The systemic racism the Vice President just referred to. The systemic racism is a stain on our nation's soul. The knee on the neck of justice for Black Americans. Profound fear and trauma. The pain, the exhaustion that Black and Brown Americans experience every single day. The murder of George Floyd launched a summer of protest we hadn't seen since the civil rights era in the 60s. Protests that unified people of every race and generation in peace and with purpose to say enough, enough, enough of this senseless killings.
Kamala Harris, the nation's first African-American vice president, spoke just before President Biden.
Today, we feel a sigh of relief. Still, it cannot take away the pain. A measure of justice isn't the same as equal justice. This verdict brings us a step closer, and the fact is, we still have work to do. We still must reform the system.
When we come back, we'll spend the rest of the hour looking at the Chauvin verdict. And we'll speak with Candace Montgomery of Black Visions Collective in Minnesota and Harvard professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad. Stay with us. Never Give Up by Curtis Mayfield. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we've reported, a jury in Minneapolis has convicted former police officer Derek Chauvin on three counts of murdering George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds last May. He's the first white police officer in Minnesota to ever be convicted of killing a black person. The jury reached its decision after 10 hours of deliberation. Judge Peter Cahill revoked Chauvin's bail and will sentence him in 2 months. He faces up to 40 years in prison for the most serious charge, second-degree murder. For more, we go to Minneapolis, where we speak with Candace Montgomery, co-executive director of Black Visions Collective, a Black-led, queer, and trans-centering community organization based in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul that's part of the movement calling to defund the police. Candace, welcome to Democracy Now! First, your reaction to the verdict.
Thank you so much for having me. My reaction, like many, was an exhale for our community. Many of us have been holding our breath in anticipation for this verdict. And though I don't think that justice can ever be served when we've lost a life in this type of situation, I do think it's important to be able to honor that exhale of a breath and honor the peace that I'm sure George Floyd's family and friends are now able to experience and feel. And so for that, for them, I, you know, am, of course, very happy.
And Candace, I'm wondering your reaction to the statements of Attorney General Keith Ellison. He gave a very lengthy statement after the verdict, going into basically the history of abuse of African Americans by law enforcement. Your reaction to that and to his role in all of this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really critical that we are lifting up this history and that Attorney General Keith Ellison is also doing so. And his work to really push for justice in this moment has been important in many ways. At the same time, you know, Attorney General Keith Ellison has also been part of the militarized occupation that is currently happening in Minneapolis and across Minnesota in preparation for this verdict, as well as response to the murder of Dante Wright. And so, you know, my offering back to the attorney general is to really look at the ways that we are able to not just reckon with the history that we have to deal with, but also look at how we are perpetuating that history in these moments, specifically by limiting the rights of Black and brown protesters right here in his state for peacefully protesting against another police murder.
And in terms of the sentencing for Chauvin will be in about approximately 8 weeks. Your sense of what would be a just sentence for him in this situation?
I don't necessarily think that I have an assessment of what would feel as a just sentence in this moment. As an abolitionist and as someone who really thinks that justice is tied up much beyond someone being imprisoned, I think it's important to really think about justice going forward actually looks like defunding and abolishing police. It actually looks like ending militarized occupation in cities that are responding to police murders and the like, and truly uprooting the hideous roots of this institution of policing and this system that continues to kill Black people at the same time that we were, exhaling or collectively celebrating the verdict of George Floyd's murder. We also witnessed another murder of a Black teenager, Micaiah Bryant, almost at the exact same time. And so really, as folks are looking forward to the sentencing, I really want to encourage people to think about justice as much more long term, and that we set our bar, our our bar a lot higher when it comes to calling for justice than an adequate sentencing or not.
Last year, Candace, in the days after the protests erupted over Derek Chauvin's murder of George Floyd, the majority of the Minneapolis City Council made a pledge to dismantle the police. This is Minneapolis City Council President Lisa Bender.
Our commitment is to end our city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, to end policing as we know it, and to recreate systems of public safety that actually keep us safe.
Around the same time last year after George Floyd's murder, organizers with your group, Black Visions Collective, and others convinced Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey to step outside his home to speak with them. In this clip, we hear you, Candace, questioning the mayor.
No. Will you defund the Minneapolis Police Department?
So that's Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey telling you, Candace Montgomery, I cannot support the full abolition of the police. Now, that was last June. I want to ask you two things. First of all, the importance of the activists. It's something that the Floyd family repeated over and over last night in thanking activists. And the only reason the first African-American elected to statewide office in Minnesota, Keith Ellison, was in charge of this prosecution is because it was taken out of the hands of Hennepin County by the governor as a result of the massive protests. And then I want to ask about the protests very much centering around this whole push for defunding the police in Minneapolis, including the city council's vote, in December to cut $8 million from the $170 million police budget and divert the funds to mental health and violence prevention. Lay out for this, for us, what you have proposed and what you feel has been accomplished and what you think needs to be accomplished.
Yeah, so for the several last years, even before 2020, Black Visions and our partner Reclaim the Block and other community organizations have been calling for the divestment from policing and in particular, the investment in our communities, investment as in investment in real safety, the things that actually create the conditions for safe and healthy and vibrant communities like housing, like healthcare, like quality access to jobs, like water that you can drink. Things like that, instead of pouring and wasting millions of dollars on policing that we know ultimately have, one, never been designed to protect and serve low-income people, people of color, ever. In fact, were intentionally created to oppress and keep us in our current conditions. That has really been our call since 2018. And so in 2020, it was really an important and immediate call to action to defund the police after the murder of George Floyd. Because for me and many of my comrades, that is what justice actually looks like, is ending this and making sure that there is never another George Floyd or a Dante Wright or Dalali Dodd or Makia Bryant or Breonna Taylor ever again. That has really been the work that we've been doing. And we have been working with the city council to push forward that demand. Right now, what that looks like here in Minneapolis is calling for the development of a Department of Public Safety and a charter change in our city that will eliminate the requirement for the current shape of our police department, the amount of officers, and really the amount of money that we waste every year here in Minneapolis on policing, and allow us to move those resources and create the infrastructure at a citywide level for real investment in safety alternatives that do not rely on the police solely, and a public health approach to how we think about safety here in Minneapolis that truly centers care for all of our people. And the city council, along with community organizers, have been working on this initiative this year and excited to bring it to voters in November, this proposed charter change. What I'll say about our mayor, Jacob Fry, is that what we've seen since last summer and to this point is that he's completely inadequate to fulfill the responsibilities of his executive role, to be clear about the types of decisions that he does or does not have power around, to actually fulfill the promises that he ran on when he was being elected, and has continuously tried to pit Black communities against each other in order to preserve his political standing and actually not move forward on investments in community safety like his constituents have been calling for. So I think it's important for people to understand the ways that our mayor has really blocked and gotten in the way of justice. You know, I want to shout out the George Floyd Square organizers who for almost an entire year have been out there every single day, out there between 8 a.m. Till late into the evening, protesting and holding down truly sacred space that is providing mutual aid and care to community members, that is curating the art of this movement so that people can memorialize and remember this moment, and is not letting the city back down from its promises. That has been so crucial. As well as the organizing led by young people during the uprising last summer that truly lit the fire under the conversation here in Minneapolis, but across the country and across the globe, and put pressure in all of the right places that were needed. And then, of course, our demands alongside others to not just call for Black Lives Mattering, but to call for a clear demand to change this system by defunding the police as we move towards abolition of the police, ultimately, over the years to come, and invest in a new model, a new future, a new vision for how we do safety. So that's really the moment here. And I really appreciate you lifting up the importance of activism, and not just activism, but intentional organizing that folks have put into intentional strategy that community members have been building for decades to get us to this point.
And it's just incredible moment of the bystanders, the passersby who simply cared, didn't know each other, including at the time the 17-year-old Darnella Frazier, who was the one who took that video. And I want to just end this conversation with a reminder of what actually came out from the police department versus what Darnella did. Shortly after Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd, the Minneapolis Police Department issued a press release describing what had happened. The release was titled, "Man Dies from Medical Incident During Police Interaction." The statement said in part, quote, "Two officers arrived and located the suspect, a male believed to be in his 40s, in his car. He was ordered to step from his car. After he got out, he physically resisted officers. Officers were able to get the suspect into handcuffs and noted he appeared to be suffering medical distress. Officers called for an ambulance. He was transported to Hennepin County Medical Center by ambulance, where he died a short time later." It was only that video, and then, of course, the eyewitness testimony of passersby who didn't know George Floyd, but who were deeply concerned about watching a slow-motion murder, that showed the lie of this press release. Your final comment, Candace.
Yes, eternally grateful for Darnella and her bravery in being willing to not only witness this murder, but record it so that the family and others could pursue justice for George Floyd. And again, the police department will continue to show its true colors and what it's actually rooted in, which is making up lies and committing crimes against humanity for the sake of maintaining its institutional power. So I think that that is important, and it should not be lost on people that here in Minnesota right now, we are experiencing extreme response, a militarized occupation of National Guard and millions of dollars being poured into policing, risking these same conditions. And so, you know, I think that it's important that we witness this, that we document these things, that we share these things, and that we continue to protest, we continue to get out in the streets, because we know that the police will lie on our name any day without hesitating, and that only we are the ones who are able to keep us safe. And Darnella reminded us of that.
And of course, Darnella was with her 9-year-old cousin who was wearing a T-shirt that said love. Candace Montgomery, co-executive director of Black Visions Collective, a Black-led queer and trans-centering community organization based in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Next up, we go to Harvard professor Khalil Gibran, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Stay with us.
What'd you say?
Forever Momentary Space by Damon Locks and the Black Monument Ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Guilty, guilty, guilty. 3 weeks after the start of the trial that was watched around the world, and after 10 hours of deliberation, a jury of 12 Hennepin County residents delivered their guilty verdicts Tuesday on all three counts against former police officer Derek Chauvin, who murdered George Floyd last May by kneeling on his back for 9.5 minutes. As we continue to discuss the verdict and its implications, we're joined by Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime and the Making of Modern Urban America. Professor Muhammad, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Take us on a journey back. Respond to the verdict, but then talk about the beginning of policing in America and its connection to slave patrols.
Good morning, Amy, and good morning, Juan. I think that this verdict, I've been thinking a lot about how to respect the family's sense of closure and what they deserve in the delivery of accountability in this case. But I've also been thinking about this in terms of battle in a broader context of a war, and that war being justice for Black people and for BIPOC people and for poor people in this country. And in this sense, the outcome of this trial represents a battle that was won, a long fought, and as Candace Montgomery so eloquently described in the work that she's been doing, the consequence of years of organizing work in Minneapolis. And just to remind you, each one of these battles will take place in the court of our country, whether it will be in Toledo, Ohio's, whether it will be in Chicago, whether it will be in this case, most recently with Micaiah Bryant in Columbus, Ohio. And so that's how I think about the trial and the work that remains. But of course, we know that while the prosecution was performing in such a way to make the case that Derek Chauvin was a rogue actor, The truth is that policing should have been on trial in that case. And we don't have a mechanism in our current system of laws in the way that we treat individual offenses to have that accountability and justice delivered. And the reason being, of course, is that our policing system was never really built to deal with individuals. It was built to control groups. And those groups ranging from indigenous people during the period of colonization and the early 19th century. And of course, for the vast majority of people of African descent in this country for 250 years in the context of chattel slavery was meant simply to protect an economic system where people had been defined as property. And if that property decided to steal itself, there would be deputized armed white men of every class and category in the society to ensure that they would not escape. And that history has never left us. That history is still with us. And policing right through this very moment remains overwhelmingly concentrated within the most divested, poorest communities in our country that are of color, because truth be told, for rural white Americans who experience severe poverty, policing per capita is much lower. So we have a system that began in the context of slavery and control and remains in its deepest roots that same system.
And Khalil, I wanted to ask you about that because I often tell my students in journalism to go back into the archival history of our newspapers to see this represented vividly. For instance, in 1706, the Boston Newsletter, the first continuously published newspaper in America, wrote, "Blacks are, quote, much addicted to stealing, lying, and purloining." And a few years later, its competitor paper, this is an amazing statement in a newspaper, said, quote, "The great disorders committed by Negroes who are permitted by their imprudent masters to be out late at night has determined several sober and substantial housekeepers to walk about the town in the sore part of the night." So the citizen watch patrols were already being developed in early 1700s to control the black population of Boston. Of course, this, as you so eloquently expressed, then becomes the actual the slave patrols and then our modern police departments. To what degree are most Americans aware of this history?
Well, I think it's fair to say most are not aware. Maybe the learning curve has steepened a bit over the past year. But the truth is, Americans, whether we talk about the origins of policing or the simple reality of the 350 years covering chattel slavery to the segregation period, we know empirically that most Americans are not taught these histories. And this is true for African-American children as well, whose curriculum are covered by state legislatures, which are dominated by whites who are not willing to come to terms or reckon with this history. And Juan, I want to say one more thing about those examples that you described. What I think is so powerful about turning to colonial and antebellum archival records is that white people did not mince their words. They were quite clear and articulate about what it is that they were doing when they simply criminalized blackness, or they simply criminalized the right to be, as my colleague Kelly Lytle Hernandez has written. And our language has become a way of obfuscating those same mechanisms. We live in a time in this modern period of social media where we have accelerated the capacity to say one thing in public, but to do something else quite differently in our policy and practice. And so those history lessons are critical. Indeed, I would say life-saving when it comes to making sure that as we move forward from this moment, if it is even possible, that we come to terms with the clarity with which past political elites talked about what they were doing.
Well, in that vein, you mentioned that initially there were attempts to control and obviously suppress the native populations. But especially in the light of the recent shooting of Adam Toledo, this history of the Latinos and other people of color. For instance, there was one book, Gunpowder Justice, that claims that the Texas Rangers just between 1915 and 1920 killed 5,000 Mexicans in the state of Texas as a suppression force. And the LA Times recently reported that there have been 465 Latinos killed by police just in Los Angeles County since 2000. That works out to about one Latino every 2 weeks for the last 20 years have been killed just in L.A. County. This whole issue of the policing being used as a means of suppression and terrorism of these communities.
Those reminders that anti-blackness may have been the motivation for the infrastructure of policing, but it didn't stop there. And I think that as part of the broader historical context in which we need to come to terms with the past as a predicate for the action and the work that is to remain. I mean, Candace Montgomery is such an articulate spokesperson for the work that's happening on the ground, but she is exceptional. And the work of the Black Visions Collective is exceptional. The work of the Anti-Police Terror Project led by James Birch in Oakland is exceptional. We still have members of Black and Brown communities that are still in need of recognizing the broader limits of police reforming themselves. And when you, Juan, describe the sheer toll that is happening within Latinx communities and tethering that to the fact that we have evidence that it may be that there were just as many people of Central American or Mexican ancestry killed by lynch mobs or by police agencies like the Texas Rangers, that number may exceed or match the numbers of recorded lynchings of African Americans in this country. It's just astounding and only shows exponentially how much terror has been an instrument of control in this country.
Always, Professor Muhammad. You've got The Guardian reporting on in a data breach, police helping to fund Kyle Rittenhouse, the young man who opened fire and killed two Black Lives Matter activists and walked away, even as people were saying, this is the guy that shot those protesters. And you've got the police acting as terrorists themselves, the whole issue of violence directed against, and you write about this eloquently, against the poor. And also, if you can talk about new immigrants and how police are used.
Thank you, Amy. Listen, the fact of how much policing is baked into every system of our society. You know, when we think about what's been happening at the border during the Trump administration, this is another expression of the way that the Trump administration simply weaponized the systems that were already in place, did not invent them. And the degree to which something like the Cal Rittenhouse example of a white man self-deputized as an anti-Black terrorist to shoot people with the protections of the so-called Second Amendment, and then to be applauded and supported, to be given water on the scene, to later receive something like $600,000 in defense funds, many of which came from law enforcement itself, or to reflect on the fact that Donald Trump received 74 million votes in this election in calling for more policing, more white nationalism, more border control, more terrorism, and that the Republican Party, as we know now, is holding up the George Floyd Policing Act as a singular unit of support for this kind of ongoing terror that's happening in this country is just remarkable. I mean, we are nowhere near able at this time to recognize some consensus on a common way forward to recognize the humanity of people, whether they are asylum seekers coming into this country from Central America or whether they were born here in any part of this country. And as much as I am hopeful for the possibilities of the activist work of people like Candace Montgomery, I think we all need to be as vigilant as possible that we are nowhere near where we need to be in order to expect that Black lives will not continue to be cut short by everything we've seen so far.
And just to say, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which was passed by the House but is being held up in the Senate, among its components, ban chokeholds, ban no-knock warrants, create a duty to intervene, create a public registry, overhaul qualified immunity. And Minneapolis Congresswoman Ilhan Omar tweeted after the verdict, "This is but a minuscule step on the path to justice. Next stops, independent agency to investigate police misuse of force, criminalize violence against protesters, demilitarize police departments, disband and deconstruct failed police departments." Your response?
Well, I think that, I think that everything that Ilhan Omar has described is on the table. And I agree with her that the Justice Floyd Act, it limits demonstrates the limits of the federal government to control 18,000 decentralized agencies. And while, as she rightly notes, it is a first step, and I think it's a good first step for that reason, much of this work will depend upon state legislatures to take over the work of transformation. And, you know, we are seeing everything from the removal of traffic violation from policing, as has happened in Berkeley more recently. We are seeing the public health authority being called upon to take greater responsibility for delivering community-based violence interruption and community-based or trauma-centered harm reduction. And I think these are all what we can imagine at this moment for bringing forward transformation. But the bottom line is we're probably not yet there for the full possibilities of what is to come. And so we have to expect over the coming weeks, months, and years that people will be experimenting on the ground, will be trying things new. But this is going to ultimately be about political accountability for elected officials, because that's where the legislative change has to happen.
And Khalil, I wanted to ask you, we're in an information society like ours, people tend to make a fetish of statistics, and crime statistics are often used by politicians. Could you talk about Frederick Hoffman, how he misused statistics to demonize Black people?
Sure. Well, in this day and age, we are having a conversation about crime statistics as an index of the threat and danger that Black people pose when we are listening to a lot of political elites and particularly police officials. While we're not having this conversation today, if we had a counterpoint, that counterpoint would be that since George Floyd was killed, the spike in violence that occurred across major cities in this country is itself evidence, prima facie evidence, statistical evidence that Black people are in need of more policing and not less policing. And this is the legacy of Frederick Hoffman, to make the argument that the evidence of crime that happens or violence or harm that happens within the community is evidence of the dysfunctionality and the dangerousness of that population. But that's a lie, and it's always been a lie, because the violence within that community is itself a symptom of the violence of the state and the violence of a society that was focused on extraction and exploitation of people. And why do we know this? Because it wasn't just Black people who experienced this. It was white people. It was European immigrants that experienced this. And about 100 years ago, the same people that produced statistics recognize that they should see violence as symptomatic of a capitalist society that is grinding people and that is committing acts of violence in the economy itself. And how to fix that was not through policing. How to fix that was to invest in those community with pro-social interventions, to give people the economic security, the collective bargaining rights, the right to be seen and to simply be, as I again, to quote my colleague Kelly Lytle Hernandez. So we are still living with Hoffman. Hoffman's legacy in defining crime statistics among Black and brown people as evidence of their dangerousness and then driving policing as the response to that is still the legacy we live with. It is the infrastructure that we, many of us, are trying to dismantle.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. And I just want to end again. You've got the three guilty verdicts on Chauvin. And then in Columbus, Ohio, right at the time the verdicts were being read, many inside watching those verdicts, a police officer fatally shot four times a black teenage girl, 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant. That does it for our show. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thanks so much for being with us. Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.